Session number 11103, Reel 2.
Wing Commander Page, Reel 2. So, but you knew that there was the probability of an invasion, and that if the Germans won the air war, that they would be across, presumably.
Dealing with your first part of the question, we were aware vaguely that there were landing barges being assembled on the other side. Don't forget, we weren't a reconnaissance unit. But I must emphasize that at no time did I ever come across anyone ever mentioning, and I didn't even think it myself, the fact that we would lose the battle. And a very good friend of mine called Al Deer, a famous New Zealand fighter pilot, he confirmed that 100%. I'm sure that was the general feeling.
Was there any sense of indignation on your part, or the part of your brother pilots, that German planes should be over our airspace?
No, I don't think so. Indignation, if there were any, was aimed at small little things. Why was the tea cold when it was brought down from the mess to our dispersal area and things like that? As for time off, we were supposed, theoretically, to get one day a week off, and I never took my day off because I was so enthusiastic, call it stupidity if you will, to get at the enemy. So I took no time off at all until I was shot down.
Was the Battle of Britain fought between the British and German pilots in a knightly way or in a brutal way?
I can only talk from my own personal point of view. People have intimated that pilots bailing out were shot at by the Luftwaffe. I never saw it happen once. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I think it's highly unlikely. Later on, the Normandy invasion, I know that pilots were shot at by the German soldiers on the ground after we'd been strafing them, and a pilot would get hit and he'd bail out, and then I think they were probably just shot to death as they came down. But you've got a different situation there where the soldiers, of course, are feeling very antagonistic towards the aircraft attacking them, and tensions running high. But in the air, no, it was, I'd say, on a very high level of camaraderie and chivalry. And today, the friendship between RAF pilots and
Was it completely anonymous, or could you ever get close to the enemy pilots?
99.9% anonymous, yes. There would be occasions where you could recognize the leader of a certain group because he'd painted the spin of his aeroplane a bright yellow colour or something like that. By and large, you know, everything happened so quickly, even in those days, that, yeah.
Some people I've interviewed before have said to me that they didn't aim at the pilots, but at the plane. Does that phrase have much meaning?
I think it's a little conceited to say that you might be aiming at the pilot as opposed to the plane, because not many men had that degree of skill to pick out virtually a pinhead in the area that you were shooting. Now, fundamentally, the engine was the, or engines, if it were a twin engine aeroplane, was the thing to aim for, because if you could set that on fire or hit a vital part of it. But the pilot sitting in a single seater fighter right behind the engine, the odds were he'd get hit as well.
Were the German planes difficult to break up? Were they robust?
No more so than ours. No, I would say that you couldn't make a feature out of the difference there. I believe the fighter pilots who flew at the Pacific, they said the Japanese aircraft made of wood, they certainly disintegrated very easily. But no, in the European theatre, I'd say there's nothing in it.
You described the first time you were in action in the Battle of Britain. What was the second time?
Oh, there were so many times I really couldn't put them in chronological order, I did think. The early phases, one action I remember, great flotilla, if that's the right naval expression, of small motor torpedo boats went out to attack their German equivalent off, I think it was Calais or Dunkirk, and two British destroyers went out, and then the Germans retaliated by sending out a large force of Stuka dive bombers to dive bomb the destroyers with a fighter escort, and that was quite fun, because as the Stukas dived off, peeled off to attack the two destroyers, we peeled off, rather like shuffling a pack of cards, one German, one Hurricane, one German, one Hurricane, and I think we got about six Stukas on that thing, because don't forget, after the Stukas pulled out of their dive at sea level, they then had to fly back to France, virtually about 10 feet above the waves. And in our Hurricanes, by throttling back the engines, we could sit behind the Stuka, and there was the poor rear gunner with just one little pop gun to defend his aeroplane. We were sitting there with eight machine guns, and they were pretty easy target. I'm not proud of the fact that one just sort of knocked them off like skittles. That was one of the reasons, of course, why they were withdrawn by the German higher authority.
Where did most of your combat activity in the Battle of Britain take place over?
Fundamentally Kent. That was the main scene of the action. That's not saying that further down the coast towards areas like Portsmouth there weren't actions. The Italians made one attack, I think, in the Portsmouth area. I was not personally involved. And they never came back again because every aircraft they sent on that Portsmouth attack was shot down. So that was the end of Benito Mussolini as far as the Battle of Britain was concerned. And then, of course, further up the coast in the opposite direction, there were attacks going on in places like, I suppose, Ipswich, Yarmouth, etc. But it was shipping first, then the Germans switched their modus operandi from attacking shipping to attacking RAF airfields, the main fighter airfields in that sort of southeast area, because Goering's theory, I believe, was that the RAF on the ground, because he couldn't do it in the air, he could then send his bomber formations to attack London. But the ingenuity of the ground crews and the fact that we hadn't got concrete runways, there was always enough grass somewhere that you could take off in between bomb holes, which were immediately marked with coloured flags. So not having been able to put RAF Fighter Command out of commission, Goering then went into the fourth phase, which was this one, the big air raids on East London and that and that. They all paid their price, as history tells us.
Did you have much contact with foreigners who fought on our side in the Battle of Britain?
In our particular squadron, apart from I think we had one New Zealander, no. Later on in the war, yes, in various units I commanded Poles, Czechs, Canadians, New Zealanders, Australians. During the battle itself, the greatest contribution was made without question by the New Zealanders, particularly when you take into account the size of their country and the population. But statistics, official ones, will show you that there were more New Zealand fighter pilots flying from Commonwealth and Dominion countries than any other country. Large number of Czechs, large number of Canadians, quite a few Poles. I think there were 13 Free French and one or two Belgians, things like that. But the New Zealanders stood out head and shoulders above everybody.
Did any of the foreigners fight any differently from the British?
Yes, the Poles were madmen, at least we thought they were. All they wanted to do, they couldn't care less about orders from the ground. If they could see the enemy, they'd attack him. And very understandably, their country had been overrun, and they had a bitterness and a hatred which emanated from that. And I think probably the Czechs were motivated by the same sort of feeling. The French and Belgians, not so much. I mean, they were brave men. I'm not belittling that at all. But the Poles and Czechs were... there was a burning hatred inside them. Very gallant men.
You talked about the defensive work of pilots in having to ascend towards the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
In the Battle of Britain, did you ever get into a position where you could come down on them?
Can't recall it. Because virtually, you know, to get up to the normal altitude which the attack would be coming in, somewhere between 15,000 and 25,000 feet. By the time radar had advised the control that the formation was coming in, he was still climbing up to intercept. That's not saying there weren't occasions when other squadrons, particularly the Spitfire ones, could get up and above, but I found in Hurricanes we were always in this nasty situation of being on the climb at a low speed. But once you got into the fight, your Hurricane was more manoeuvrable than certainly anything the Germans had, and it was a solid machine. So you had tremendous confidence in it.
Did you have very undertrained pilots being thrown into the Battle of Britain?
Towards the end, yes. They were coming from flying training school and put straight into the squadron. Well, obviously, we'd try and nurse them along with a bit of flying before actually going into combat, but you're only talking just a few hours. For example, when a pilot would arrive, he would be sent on probably a couple of flights just doing a thing called sector reconnaissance, which means that you've got to get to know the area over which your squadron is defending. So you look out for the main landmarks, such as rivers, towns, this and that, so that you don't have to use a map at all. But after that, then the new pilot would be told to fly alongside someone who was pretty experienced.
Can you describe in detail how you did get shot down in August?
Yes, we'd taken off from North Weald, as I said, which is just outside Epping, and we landed, I think, just as the dawn was coming up at Manston Airfield. I tell a lie, excuse me. We landed at Rochford, which is now Southend International Airport, and we spent the day there, meals being brought to us, then we'd fly, have a fight, come back. And then at about, it was 5 o'clock in the evening, we were all sitting around having tea on the grass alongside a tent, and in this tent was one of these field telephones. You wind a handle and the bell rings. That was connected, that telephone, to the sector operations. So they phoned through somewhere around about 5 o'clock and said there was an attack coming in. And our squadron, by then, we were losing quite a lot of people. We were supposed to muster 12 aircraft for the attack on the enemy, but in fact we only had 10. So the 10 of us took off, and as we climbed, the usual procedure, the controller said that there were 90 bandits, as the enemy are called, were approaching from the south, and there was about 15,000 feet. And again, the usual thing, as we climbed up, we could see the swarm of what looked like little insects beginning to take shape, and it was a large formation of Dornier 217 bombers escorted by Messerschmitt 109 fighters. Well, the 10 of us, again in this climbing attitude, we were catching up slowly with the bombers, who by that time had been able to drop their load on Manston Airfield. This was part of Goering's strategy to put the airfields out of action. They then flew up northwards out over the Thames estuary, and we chased them, and I was in the leading section of three, and the one nearest to the German bombers. I was on the right hand side. Then I could see all this tracer ammunition coming from the whole formation. They'd singled me out as the target. Probably they had a radio control gunnery officer who was saying, pick out that particular British fighter and shoot at him. And all these things that looked like lethal electric light bulbs kept flashing by until suddenly there was an enormous bang, and then the whole aircraft just exploded. The scientists reckon the temperature goes up from a cool room temperature at 15,000 feet to 3,000 degrees centigrade in about 10 seconds. So when you consider water boils at 100 degrees centigrade, you've got quite a temperature change there on your hands. So if you don't get out in virtually just a few seconds, you're not going to get out. And then the beauty of the excellent Royal Air Force training came to my rescue. I instinctively carried out the drill of releasing the harness that strapped me to my seat, and I slid the hood back, rolled the aircraft onto its back, and virtually I kicked the flying control column, so the aircraft pointed its nose upwards, but as I was upside down, that sort of popped me out of the aircraft like a cork out of a toy gun. But stupidly, and no one really knew in those days, stupidly I wasn't wearing any gloves. And later on it became mandatory to wear gloves. My hands got a terrible burning, and face as well. My mouth and nose were saved by my oxygen mask. And then I found myself tumbling head over heels through space. I remember seeing my right arm extended, and I sort of looked at it. My brain ordered it to bring it in and pull the metal ring of the ripcord on the parachute. And that was agony, because this cold metal ring and badly burned hand, it's like an electric shock. Anyway, if you don't have a choice, you've got to pull the thing, otherwise the parachute won't open. So I then found myself floating down. First natural instinct was to look up to see if the parachute was on fire. Fortunately it wasn't, and then one took stock of the situation. I noticed quite a funny thing had happened. My left shoe and my trousers had been blown off completely by the explosion. I was just about almost naked from the waist downward. My legs were slightly burned, and I could hear the fight going on all around me, because when you're on a parachute, there's no engine noise, and it's surprising how sound travels. Well, it took me, I suppose, about 10 minutes to float down into the water, and there were various problems I had. First of all, when I hit the water, I had to get rid of the parachute. Well, you do this by turning a metal disc, which is just about over your stomach, and you turn it through 90 degrees and then give it a hard thump, and all the parachute harness breaks away. Well, that's the theory of it, but when your hands are very badly burned, it's difficult to turn the buckle, which is quite stiff, and then to thump it. So I found myself in the water, still connected to the parachute, but the parachute had come down on top of me, so I was really inside a tent with all these cords, shrouds, they call them, from the parachute, rather like an octopus's claws, tentacles. And I knew that if I didn't get away from the parachute quickly, it would get waterlogged and sink and take me with it. So again, desperation comes into the issue, and you know that if you don't turn that metal disc and if you don't thump it, that's the end of you. So you do turn it, you do thump it. And I must say, it was very painful. I got rid of that, and then I thought, well, the next thing now is to blow up my life-saving jacket. You have a little tube which is just over your left shoulder, and I got hold of this little rubber tube and started to blow into it after I'd opened the valve on it, and all that came out the other end were bubbles, because the parachute, the life-saving jacket had been burned through. Well, my face was beginning to swell up from the burns by this point. I couldn't get my helmet off. The leather strap under my chin had, I suppose, been so badly seared, it was, you just couldn't undo it. So I set off for the distance, but my eyesight was beginning not to fail, but my swollen eyelids and everything were beginning to close up, so the distant view of England, which I could see quite a few miles away, was getting more and more blurred, but I knew the vague direction I had to set out for. So I started swimming, and then a happy thought came into my mind, that in my jacket pocket was a brandy flask that my dear mother had given me, which I'd filled with brandy, thinking that on some occasion or other there would be an emergency, and I'd need the brandy. Well, quite often in the mess of previous weeks, when the bar had closed, my fellow pilot said, "Come on, Geoffrey, you've got a brandy flask there, let's have a tot of brandy." And I said, "No, one day I may have an emergency." So as I was swimming along, I thought, this probably qualifies for an emergency. So with that happy thought, I rolled over onto my back and went on swimming, kicking my legs, and that was another painful business, getting my hands under the useless life-saving jacket and undo the tunic flap, which had a button on it. Eventually I got it undone, got the brandy flask out, but I couldn't hold it properly in my hand, so I held it between my wrists and undid the screw cap with my teeth. Oh, well, going to be a more pleasant life. Lifted up the my wrists to take a swig of the brandy, and at that moment a dirty big wave came along and knocked it out of my wrist, and the whole lot went to the bottom of the channel. I was a bit annoyed about that, but anyway, I had no choice. I had to continue swimming towards England, and then after a while I heard more than saw a boat. I could hear the chug-chug of its small engine, and it turned out to be a whaler, which is a small lifeboat put off by a Trinity Lifehouse vessel which had seen me come down. There were two men in it, and it was interesting. They kept on asking me questions. By this time I'd been swimming for about half an hour, and that was a bit tired and fed up with the whole affair. So when they said to me, are you a Jerry, this and that, I'm afraid I let loose with every rude four-letter word I could think of, and that immediately assured them that I was an RAF officer. And they picked me out of the water, and then they took me to the big ship, where the captain of the ship dressed me, my burns, with lint, and they gave me a cup of tea. And then the Margaret lifeboat came out of Margaret Harbour and took me off the Trinity Lifehouse vessel and into Margaret, where they were going to transfer me to Margaret Hospital. And for the first time for about, I suppose, an hour or more by then, I was able to laugh, because waiting on the quayside was the mayor of Margaret, dressed in a tail suit and a top hat. Which, you know, when you've been in an air fight an hour before, and then there's a chap in a top hat and a tailcoat saying, "Welcome to Margaret." It's two different worlds.
What was the date?
I remember it well. That was the day grouse shooting began, August the 12th. Certain irony in grouse shooting and myself. So I spent a few days in Margaret Hospital, then I was taken up to the Royal Masonic Hospital in London, and then later on I found myself in Sir Archibald McIndoe, the plastic surgeon's hospital at East Grinstead, where I spent 2 years undergoing plastic surgery, and then went back flying in, I think it was about November 1942.
Can you tell me what you think about McIndoe and his treatments?
Oh, fantastic. I mean, for his time, he was so far ahead, both as a surgeon and as a humanitarian. He was quite unique.
Who was in East Grinstead with you?
Well, the names that perhaps people will recall, most famous name was another bad pilot called Richard Hillary, who wrote a book called The Last Enemy. And then there were a few RAF fighter pilots, the majority, I suppose, of the people in there who were also RAF were either bomber pilots or people from other commands who'd been injured in training accidents, getting burnt flying at night while they were learning to fly night bombers. But a group of us who were fighter pilots, we got together and formed a little club which we call the Guinea Pig Club, and from the six of us who started it, there have been about 700 went through that hospital and became members of the Guinea Pig Club.
Whose idea was it?
I think just these few of us. We thought, well, when we were allowed to get out of bed and walk a few yards, there was a little hut. And we said, well, why don't we form a little sort of club in there where we can have a glass of beer and get away from the ward for half an hour or so. I don't think it was anyone's particular idea.
Who were the six? Can you remember?
The oldest of our group was a man called Tom Gleave, and there was a fellow called Michael Coote, and can we pause there? It was such a long time ago, I can't remember all the names precisely, but I wrote a book called Tale of a Guinea Pig, and there's a photograph of our group together with McIndoe, and then that same photograph is in a book by Tom Gleave called I Had a Row with a German. Sadly, I think only two of us are still alive.